Now, I call my talk Monster or Miracle, Pregnancy and Birth in Italian Renaissance Art, because it really addresses the dualism that you find emerging very strongly in the Renaissance, the difference between the pure virgin body of the virgin and the real body of ordinary women. Now, in the late Middle Ages, the cult of the Virgin Mary was enormously strong throughout Europe, and many virgins, and I say virgins in the plural because they often were virgins related to specific places, had their own kind of mythologies. But within the church itself, there was a great debate about the figure of Mary. For example, could she have conceived and remained a virgin? How should conception be depicted? And when did she become immaculate? At her conception? In the womb? At birth? At the Annunciation, or in the mind of God before her conception. Numerous metaphors referred to Mary's role as a receptacle, because, as stated in the Mass during Lent, he whom the whole world cannot contain enclosed himself in your womb and was made man. In the Old Testament, she is described as a temple, a manna pot, an unopened gate, a sealed fountain, an enclosed garden, and a tabernacle. The Middle Ages added bridal chamber, shrine, hall, palace, and reliquary, whereas a Byzantine hymn goes for stauncher terms such as fortress, treasure house, sanctuary, and font. But from the early Renaissance onwards, one of the miracles at the heart of Western Christianity became a central focus within art. Innumerable artists painted icons of the Annunciation, the moment when the angel Gabriel flew down from heaven to tell the chosen one, the Virgin Mary, that she would bear the Son of God. The beginning of the Renaissance, the Renaissance really begins in 1306, a very important year when Dante published his Divine Comedy, written in Tuscan rather than in Latin, so for the people, and Giotto painted his remarkable series of frescoes telling the life of Christ and the Virgin Mary in the Scriveni Chapel in Padua. Now, I've got two images here, one of which is Giotto's, of course, which indicates that he's only just emerging out of the Middle Ages, not least because of the architecture, where there is less of a focus on getting perspective, because, of course, the mathematics of perspective wasn't known. But very important that we should read this image, which is high up, as you can see, just on the edge of a spandrel within the chapel, as Mary inside a domestic space. She has a curtain that has been pulled back. You see her at her prie-dieu, her kneeling a prayer stall, and she has her arms folded across her breast. Whereas in Leonardo da Vinci's Annunciation, we have, much later, we have her sitting outside a stone building with a classical sarcophagus turned into a prie-dieu. So incorporating references to the classical world. Now, Giotto's remarkable frescoes are noted for introducing an entirely new focus on human life, with a naturalism never seen before and beginning a movement that was to change understandings about the human body and the world in which it lived. Giotto's paintings in the chapel are revolutionary, not least because human emotion and what we would now describe as psychological responses to events became all important in making the faithful both understand and fully share the religious figures and events within each painted or sculpted surface. Although initially interpreting the Virgin as a passive figure, obediently accepting her appointed role, by the 15th century, church teachings identified five different kinds of response on the part of Mary to the miraculous appearance of the angel Gabriel. The first of these was called reflection, where instead of looking at the angel, she gazes up towards the divine light shining directly towards her, the Holy Ghost in the form of the dove speeding down those golden rays, and it's at the moment that the dove arrives at her body that she conceives. So the angel in this work is passively, he is sort of in adoration, if you like, with his arms crossed and looking down. But already there's a difference to that early work by Giotto, because her prayer book is very obvious, open on this cushion in front of her. And all, this is a detail because I wanted you to be able to see the work more clearly. But in actual fact, there's a Turkish carpet below her, which is introducing a local detail, because obviously the artist, and we don't know who the artist was, it was said to be a priest who fell asleep because he felt he couldn't paint the angel's face and woke up, the Virgin's face, and woke up and the angel had finished it for him. So this is a very important Annunciate Virgin. The next category was that of humility and submission. And now you see that it's Mary who looks down rather than up as the golden light and the holy dove speed towards her. But then you start to get in more sophisticated imagery at the end of the 15th century, this notion of disquiet. Because after all, if an angel appeared before you and told you you were to be the Son of God, you might be a tad surprised and a little nervous. So what you're doing is you've got artists and church writers actually thinking about human response. The fourth is inquiry, and this the same Leonardo detail from that same Leonardo that I showed you, where she doesn't give an answer directly, but she queries what she's been asked to do. And then that fifth stage, which is merit. And this work by Antonello da Messina is the most remarkable painting, because, of course, even the angel isn't there. This is a woman sitting, reading. And if there is an angel, he's in her head as much as anywhere else. So they're very, as you can see, there's very sort of sophisticated development that takes place. Now, this dissemination of ideas, the different interpretations of the Annunciation, really develops even further with the introduction at the end of the 15th century of printmaking, because prints, unlike paintings, could easily be transported. And so artists in cities throughout Europe could study one particular composition and very quickly adapt it to their own. And I just thought I'd show you this example, because Federico Barocci is far more famous as a painter than a printmaker. And he lived in Urbino. So he has set his Annunciation in a room, and we are in the room, but unusually we look through a window into the landscape of Umbria, and you have this the principal palace in Urbino on the hillside behind. So this is whereas there are intimations even in those early domestic interiors that this is happening on earth, now we have the Annunciation happening in a specific city. And this is what many artists started to do. What I love about the print of the work is that he introduces, and it's hard to tell in the painting because it's been damaged over time, but I'll see if I can make this work. There is something here, but there's no chair, whereas the chair with the cat is really unusual. And so it makes it seem far more like a domestic house. And the cat, in many, many Renaissance paintings, actually tended to have a negative connotation associated with evil and witchcraft. The dog was always a symbol of fidelity and much more trusted. So it's very interesting that Barocci has included this, and we can only assume that it's its own cat that's sitting on that chair. Well, I'd like to think so anyway. Going back to Giotto and what I mentioned earlier about the debate that kept taking place within the church as to the moment when Mary became immaculate. One of the ways that artists argued this was by making her own birth miraculous. And church, the church was debating this at the time, because remember, we're in the Old Testament, and Joachim, who is, of course, a Hebrew, is driven out of the temple because he has failed to produce a child. He goes out into the wilderness, and I love this lovely stylized little rocky wilderness with the dogs and the sheep, guarding his sheep. He falls asleep and he dreams that an angel comes to him and tells him that his wife Anna, who is now old and past the age of childbearing, will miraculously conceive. Whereas when you look at the Anna, she's inside her domestic interior, because women were very rarely portrayed out of doors. They were mainly portrayed inside a building of one sort or another, unless it was some kind of allegory. She's in a very simple interior. And her nurse, her maid spinning outside the bedroom door, has no idea that this wonderful angel has sort of rocketed through a very tiny window to tell her that she will give birth. But this is not the moment of her annunciation. And what is so, this, the most to me revolutionary painting in this whole chapel is this work on the left, the meeting at the Golden Gate. Because Giotto defines the kiss on the lips when Joachim and Anna meet at the Golden Gate, both knowing what is to take place, as the moment of conception. Now, this was very closely aligned to the act that then would take place, which would allow her to conceive. And, of course, not every church member was that keen on that kind of interpretation. And eventually that was banned, that image, that composition was banned by the church. So that by the end of the 15th century, in this tiny detail of Ghirlandaio's Birth of the Virgin, you've actually got Joachim and Anna merely embracing, but there's no kiss on the lips. Actually, when I was 15, my mother told me you got pregnant by kissing. So it's a very old idea. She was wrong. She knew it. However, but perhaps the most important for our talk today is looking at images of the pregnant Madonna. Now, there are very, very few paintings of the, it's in Italian it's called the Madonna del Parto, which is the Madonna of birth. And so it is very, very similar to Ron Merck's Pregnant Woman. It's that moment before birth. And as with the Annunciation, you get various interpretations of the theme. Now, on the left-hand side, Rossello Jacopo Franchi, you've got a giant Madonna. And the tiny little figures, these little of angels, are kneeling below her, worshipping her. She has tied around under her breasts a girdle, and the girdle became a very important symbol, which I'll come back to later on. But the girdle of the Virgin is still believed to be held in one of the churches in Prato today. Now, this particular painting is in Palazzo Davanzati in Florence, which is now the museum of the Florentine house, and it's on quite a small scale. So these were devotional images that were painted for women to have in their house as a kind of, if you like, a kind of iconic midwife. Whereas the one on the right by Nardo di Cioni is in the Church of San Lorenzo in Florence, and you can see that it's quite badly damaged. The reason it's damaged is that, and I'll elaborate on that to come, is that it was eventually covered with plaster and removed from sight. But more of that anon. Now, the girdle was often gifted, a girdle was often gifted to young girls as part of their marriage portion. And it was a powerful symbol because fastened, the sense was it denied access. Loosened, it symbolized promise. And in Italian, the term for pregnant is incinta, the same word as for girdle. And as now, not everyone conceived with ease, although for women, far more rested on their fecundity than it does today in Western society, at least. Numerous aids were resorted to when a woman failed to conceive. The Italian anthropologist Vittorio Dini quotes from texts that recommended the advocacy of roosters and other animals' testicles, wolves' milk, serpent's bone, nightingale heart, sperm, menstrual blood, mouse soup, and finally dragon's blood as aiding the growing fetus and mother. You will be relieved to know that these were to be collected, dried, pulverized, and transformed into unguents with the addition of animal and vegetable fats rather than ingested by mouth. But of course, much theological debate focused on whether fertility had only come with sin. Thomas Aquinas refuted this idea, arguing that God must have intended Eve to have a sexual role, as in all other respects, a male helper would clearly have been preferable. But there was this great paradox within the church, because you had to sin in order to conceive, but you were in a state of grace once you became pregnant. There were also theological arguments as to whether Mary also bled. Another theologian, Gregory, insisted that women should be allowed to enter a church while menstruating, but the polluting nature of blood was seen to be yet another sign of women's lesser nature. Numerous texts written during the Renaissance, not just by men, but also by women, on behalf of their daughters, stressed that modesty, decorum, silence and obedience was essential behaviour if you were to avoid being tarnished by gossip and slander, leading the unsuspecting reader to suppose that women had little opportunity for individuality and self-expression. While for women, marriage, whether to a man or to the church, was her lot in life, working women toiled the field and produced children while still working. But for patrician women, their one moment of public recognition occurred as a result of motherhood. It's also interesting to note that provided a woman remained entirely true to her husband, she was often considered pure in spite of producing children. Perhaps the most famous image of the pregnant Madonna is Piero della Francesca's Madonna del Parto in the little village of Montechi, which was painted, we think, around 1460. Jacopo de Voragine's medieval text, The Golden Legend, was enormously popular throughout Europe. Voragine addressed what he felt were omissions in the Bible, taking the sparsely recorded references to the Virgin, John the Baptist, and other saints, and filling them out with local detail. In his narrative of Mary's life, he made the association between the womb and the tomb, for in order for Christ to resurrect and save the world, he had to be born of a woman and die like other humans. This interpretation is important when considering Piero's monumental Madonna. In the little chapel for which this was commissioned, there was already a wooden Madonna and child which was deemed to be miraculous. So Piero decided to paint the Madonna del Parto, but in a way quite different to any other interpretation that is now known about. She stands in front of a tent, or as they called in Italian, a padiglione, which was also very popular at the time as a sort of covering over a bed. She is revealed to us by two identical angels, who one's actually the exact reverse of the other, who draw back the opening of the ermine-lined tent to reveal the Virgin within. The white of the fur lining is mirrored in the white of the Virgin's shift, symbolizing her ongoing purity in this late stage of pregnancy. Her hand, gesturing towards the unfastened opening in her highly contemporary 15th century maternity gown, draws our attention to the miracle that is about to take place. Piero was famed for his mathematical precision, but he also had a great understanding of theatre. For at a certain time of day, light passes through a small oculus in the rear wall of the church, coming to rest on the Virgin's swollen belly, a moment of pure epiphany. Her position on the wall, above the altar, meant that when the priest raised the host to be blessed during communion, it too was placed in front of Mary's womb, the Word made flesh. Montechi, the village where the Madonna del Parto is located, although the painting can now be found in the little museum rather than in its original chapel, is named after the Etruscan site known as Mons Ercole, or the Mountain of Hercules. It's a little mountain. He was the son of Junone, or Juno, and the mound was a sacred place in the pre-Christian period. The stream that rises there was believed to come from Hercules' divine mother and has a long association with fertility and pregnancy. Numerous small clay votive figures have been found in the soil near the stream, indicating the ancient nature of worship at the site. In the Renaissance, local women often took the new swaddling clothes to be washed there prior to giving birth. Now, when this work was cleaned just a few years ago, the conservators decided that as the top, you can see when you look at the top of this work, that it's been overpainted. There's a great crack along there. And they painted in what they assumed was the lunette shape of the top of the tent. But because they then thought that, in fact, it might have had a pointed top to it, when you go to see that now, all of that has been removed. And there's something about it which takes away, diminishes its power. By placing it in a museum as well, it's become an art object rather than an iconic image. But this work is quite startling because she places her hand in the opening of her gown. She points directly to the child in her womb, but that opening gown also symbolises the opening of the body at the moment of birth. And you'll note that in the other work, Cosimo Tura, which is simply an allegory of the muse Polyhymnia, who was a muse for fertility in the fields, she's wearing an identical maternity dress. And I'll show you another example later. So we know absolutely that this is that she's a modern Madonna of her time. Now, another theme that became very popular was that of the visitation. Mary, when she's pregnant, goes to visit Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, who also has miraculously conceived when she's past the age of childbearing. And it's interesting to compare these two because in the Giotto's image, the heaviness of the body is quite apparent. And the older woman, even though she's older, she leans in respect and devotion towards Mary because she knows that Mary carries the Son of God. Whereas because of the draping cloaks in Ghirlandaio's painting, we actually don't see the mound of the pregnant body. It's been erased from sight. In very early images of the Nativity, going back to the 3rd and 4th century, in both examples here, these come from the baptistry in the Museum of the Duomo in Florence. These are mosaics. You see the Virgin, the Nativity, has taken place within a sort of red on the left and paler coloured form, which in itself is like a kind of uterus, a kind of womb. This imagery, it disappears later in the Middle Ages. But there's a very different, definite link between the earth. She's not in an architectural setting. She's almost in a kind of cleft in the rock in a cave in these early works. Now, many scenes of childbirth from the 14th century onwards contain numerous references to contemporary social rituals, particularly in Florence. And Florence is easy to study because so many of the families, there wasn't an aristocracy, and so families who became wealthy kept records of and inventories of everything that was in their houses and of all the activities that took place. So it's a very wonderful place for research. And in Florence, a bedchamber could function as either a public or private place, depending on the activities taking place at the time. A groom was expected to decorate the bedroom before his young wife was led for the first time through the city to meet her husband. And for many, this was only the second or third time that she'd been in his presence. Until the moment the nervous young bride's friends and associates left the room, the bedroom was a place for entertainment, so a public space. Only then did it become briefly private while the marriage was consummated. And elaborate rituals were set in place at times of birth to denote the bedroom as a private place. If for a first for a start, it had to be enclosed. And so the windows were covered with cloth and symbolically closed with wax put into the door locks so that no light could pass through. So by shutting out air and daylight and closing up all these apertures, it meant that the woman wouldn't be aware of passing time. She wouldn't see the sun come up and go down and realize how long she was laboring for. So there were always candles, but of course it made it a little bit like being inside a church with everything in candlelight. She was also given what was known as a caudle, which was a drink of hot wine or gruel sweetened with sugar and flavoured with spices, which was to keep up her strength and spirits, and hopefully the wine was strong enough that it might numb a little bit of the discomfort. But in scenes of the birth of Christ, you had to stick fairly closely to what was dictated in the Bible. But with the birth of Mary or the birth of John the Baptist, artists were really able to demonstrate their new knowledge of perspective and architecture that was related specifically to the time. So in this work by Pietro Lorenzetti, which is quite an early work, you've got two scenes taking place. You have Anna, quite monumental, but lying on her bed, but on top of the bed, not in it. You've got the baby being bathed before being swaddled, but you've also got the next step in the narrative, which is women bringing gifts to the mother of food and wine. Whereas in that hallway outside, you've got Joachim being informed of his daughter's birth. So it's like a little cartoon. There are various stages in the narrative. This particular work by Giovanni da Milano, you've got a very miraculous Mary, able to stand on her 2 feet the minute she is born. You have the father writing down the name. Until the name was recorded, the child wasn't legitimately his. But once it was written down, he had taken responsibility for it. But you've also got this lovely detail of the swaddling cloth or nappy being held up before the fire, being aired in front of the fire, and a very bright, polished brass little bathing bowl, far too small for this child to actually fit in. But the mother certainly looks as if she's been through quite a tough time and she's ready for a good lie down. Whereas, in an elaborate work such as this, Hugo van der Goes' Portinari Altarpiece, you have a much more complex composition. This work was extremely influential because it was painted by a Flemish artist for a hospital in Florence. And in the north of Europe, there were many different rituals that were quite separate to Florentine rituals. And in particular with artists, there was a great focus on naturalism. So you didn't try to idealise ordinary people, whereas, of course, you did idealise the Virgin. But what is implied in this work is that the baby has appeared miraculously and that Mary hasn't actually gone through the process of birth. And you get this appearing more and more in apocryphal texts at the time. But my favourites, I have to say, are Ghirlandaio's frescoes in Santa Maria Novella. They're on either side of the choir. And these, really, more than any others, are a celebration of Florentine life. In The Birth of the Baptist, you've got a very simple interior. Mary, again, quite monumental. Elizabeth, quite monumental, sitting up in bed. But you have this very domestic detail of the maid behind her bringing her a tray covered in a cloth with wine and food. You have the wet nurse, a new introduction, seated in the foreground, but painted in the pose of a sculpture of Juno, breastfeeding the baby for the first time, while the nurse beside her holds out her hand to take the baby and to bathe it. But already identified women of the girl and of the Tornabuoni family who commissioned the fresco are entering the scene to witness, to visit the mother and witness this miraculous birth. So a very sophisticated interlocking of time and a period. While the figure that comes in at the side is carrying a veritable sort of cornucopia on a tray. And her flowing garments, blown by the wind, suggests that she's a classical figure come from another period again. Now compare that interior with the birth of the Virgin, because this is perhaps the most elaborate interior that I've seen in a birth scene, and reflects the carvings of Donatello, one of the leading sculptors of the time in Florence. And you have, that's the little detail on the left that you'll recognise from the meeting at the Golden Gate. So you've now got the conception of Mary taking place in the left hand of the image, and then you've got her birth below, and more of the family of the Tornabuoni coming in to visit this work. The young figure at the front actually died in childbirth at the age of 17. So for the family, it also was a poignant reminder of her loss. Now, the Madonna del Latte was often described also as a Madonna del Parto, and milk and blood have very strong connections in the Renaissance, because milk was deemed to come from blood. After a child was born, the father of the infant was not allowed to sleep with his wife again until she had finished breastfeeding, because it was thought that if she conceived again, the blood needed to form the baby would rob milk from her breast and the child would be malnourished. So the use of wet nurses became very popular. And this meant, of course, that patrician women had far more chance of conceiving rapidly after the delivery of their child. And because it was common to send newborn babies to wet nurses who lived in the healthier air of the countryside rather than the possibly pestilential air of the city, many mothers only saw their babies when they returned fully weaned at about the age of two. Lacking the possible protection from conception, which was a benefit of breastfeeding, women in the city, therefore, had a much higher birth rate than their rural counterparts, where the dangers associated with childbirth are a constant threat to life. But that link between blood and milk also is seen in the body of Christ, because the blood that comes from his cut side, and that's why I was particularly interested in the little figure of the man with a stab wound, which is like the lance wound in Christ's side in the Merck show. That blood was interpreted by many to be milk feeding the faithful. So they had a very interesting understanding or a belief about the crossover of those two fluids. But also those ideas really had an influence on the power of imagining. And many people, when they were in sort of spiritual trances, believed that they saw lactation miracles. St. Bernard of Clairvaux knelt in prayer before a particular statue of the Madonna del Latte, and she sprang to life and three drops of milk landed on his lips. St. Gertrude the Great took her turn at nursing the Christ child, while the Blessed Angela of Foligno reported that in a vision she too had drunk milk from the wound in Christ's side. Apparently in the early Christian period, chalky white deposits were scraped from what became known as the Milk Chapel in Bethlehem, a cave where Mary was believed to have spilled some of her milk. These samples were mixed with water and became the innumerable relics of the Madonna's milk, which you can still find throughout Europe. Not everyone took this as fact, however, and St. Bernardino of Siena sardonically commented that if indeed that was true, then Mary must have given more milk than 100 cows. But it was only after the Council of Trent, after the 1530s, that superstitions such as these were formally repressed, as was the iconography of the Madonna del Parto. They were banned as being too close to women's actual experience. But there still remains, and I'm sorry about the quality of the slide on the left, but I've never found that reproduced anywhere apart from in a really funny little book I found in an archive in Florence. And I was allowed to photograph it with my rather bad camera, and I got flare at the bottom. But it's the only image I have. It's very, very rare because it shows a mother. And because she's the mother of St. Bartholomew, you know, she is a woman of importance, but she's actually breastfeeding her own child, whereas, as noted, the role of the wet nurse was far more common. But also the swaddling of the child appears again and again in Renaissance art, because the child wasn't deemed to be fully living until it was clothed. Yet you often get images of the naked Christ child to demonstrate his humanity. So there's a real sort of paradox within that. So it was the swaddling, in effect, was seen as a humanizing act. But as for images of real birth, these appeared almost always in texts, because texts could be read privately, and often written in Latin, and so only the educated could read and understand them. But they often refer very specifically to practice, because, of course, women gave birth on a birthing stool. Very few women gave birth in bed, and they only gave birth in bed if it was thought that they were possibly dying and too exhausted to stay upright any longer. And as you can see in the image on the right, women were invited into the birth chamber to assist the mother, and two women used to take turns holding the mother round, supporting her under her arms. It's interesting when you think of the Ron-Murk and the hands above the head, because in fact that also lifts up the ribs. So the baby would be delivered into onto a stool that usually had a cushion on it. And it's thought by some writers that that's what influenced the very common 16th century image of the Christ child sitting on a cushion, that it is still a reference to actual birth practice. But you also get some really wonderful and unusual images in manuscripts. And I love this work, this very rare work on the left, because it shows the Virgin Mary being delivered naked and with the assistance of midwives, something she didn't have, but which, you know, I'm sure a woman commissioned this, and she wanted the Virgin Mary to have all of the assistance that she had, so midwives were introduced. But also, this is a very contemporary birth because the father's present. He's not sitting outside. Now, you could never have done that in a painting that was going to go on in a house or on the wall of a church, but you could do it in a manuscript. But you also find references, as the one on the right by Jean Bondol, which actually shows a woman surgeon performing a cesarean section. It actually is the birth of Caesar, which of course is where the term comes from. Now, until the 16th century, if a child was born by cesarean section, the mother died. And they were only performed at the very last minute to save the child and to baptize it. Because if the child was taken from the mother and died, it had to be buried in the graveyard they actually call it the graveyard of Limbo. And in Florence, one of the oldest parts of Florence, there's a courtyard outside a tiny church which you walk through now, and most people won't realise that you're walking over the graves of hundreds of tiny unbaptised babies. They've now sealed it over. So it was very, very important to get a live child. And there were examples of midwives being given permission to baptise the child in utero so that it could be buried with its mother. And there's a number of records about this. But in Naples, they actually had midwives who rushed the stillborn child to a church, stood in front of the high altar, claimed the baby had came back to life, baptised it, and then turned around and said it had died again. And the church never, ever questioned it, because they understood that absolute human need that your child go to heaven at a time where, you know, the thought of being sent to limbo was an eternal fate. But you actually also get images in little manuscripts and sometimes in tiny frescoes which relate to real human conception. And the one on the left is fascinating because you've got the little potty pushed under the bed, the shrub, which of course is like the tree of life. And we know that this is a good couple because they both have their hair dressed. So you slept naked, but you must never go to bed with your hair out, or it was considered immoral. So as long as you had your wonderful sort of hat on, you were fine. Whereas bathhouses were seen as absolute dens of immorality. And the scene on the right demonstrates that sharing a public bath, as many people did, was a sure sign that you were going to get up to something immoral. So you have this couple kissing on the mouth while the dog is making use of all the food left on the table. And so there's sort of a moral underlying it. But you also start to get portraits of pregnant women. And it's thought, in fact, that La Graveda, the painting by Raphael, may be a portrait of his wife, but there's no name on the portrait, so we cannot be certain. But we know absolutely that in this much larger mural of the crossing of the Red Sea, which is in the Palazzo della Signoria in Florence, Cosimo, the first Duke de' Medici's wife, is shown abundantly pregnant, witnessing the scene of the crossing of the Red Sea. But now let's get on to the monstrous, because one of the things that weaves right the way through the Renaissance is the real fear of having a monstrous birth. And whereas some of the images that are drawn are believed to possibly be fantastical and just simply be grotesque, for example, you have Leonardo's grotesque heads on the left, Quentin Massisa's old woman, nicknamed the Ugly Duchess, apparently after the Duchess in Alice in Wonderland by more recent viewers. But you also have this scene of this monstrous woman with enormous breasts on the lower area, which again, of course, is in a manuscript. But if you go to the convent of San Marco in Florence and you walk through the courtyard where you can look through windows to where the loggia where the priests are allowed to parade, there's a figure just like this of a hag warning them of the evil and sin inherent in women and sexuality. But you also start in the 16th century to get scientists and doctors trying to understand what creates what was deemed at the time to be monstrosity. And there are some very poignant examples. The little girl on the upper two images, the naked and clothed monster, which is the titles of the painting, they're both in the Prado in Madrid. And this child actually had a degree of some form of obesity, and she died shortly after the paintings were actually done. But if you had a body that wasn't considered normal, your body became public property. There was no sense of privacy. And one of the most famous examples is the family of Petrus Gonsalves. Now, he was from Tenerife. He was a very educated man. He spoke Latin fluently. And he was people like this were collected in courts to sort of entertain people. And he had married a Dutch woman when he was in Holland. And some of their children were born hirsute and some of them weren't. And there was obviously a very large painting done at one stage of the whole family, and then it got cut up and given to different collectors to keep. But the disease actually now, in 1933, the disease, which is, I've got the Latin name here somewhere, I'll find it. Yes, hypertrichosis universalis. There was actually a documentary about it recently because there's a whole group of people in India who suffer from this disease. But it's now known as the Ambras syndrome because most of these paintings are in Castle Ambras in Austria. Now, because not all of the children suffered from hirsutism, If you put all the different sections of the painting together, you'll notice something quite remarkable. Not in this particular work here, but in the painting itself, the father is grouped with the hirsute children, and the mother is grouped with the children without hair. Now, normally the mother, a woman, is always placed on the sinister or left-hand side of a man in double portraits because that shows her lesser, weaker place. This is one portrait where those roles are reversed, because a man covered in hair was thought to be closer to the animal world than the woman. And they went. This family actually went to Bologna and met the very famous Dr. Ulisse Aldrovandi, and he studied them to try and come to an understanding of why they were as they were. And the woman artist Lavinia Fontana did a quite well-known portrait of one of the little girls. But what brought about the greatest change in attitudes to women was actually the removal of the ban on dissection that the Catholic Church had in place until the beginning of the 16th century. And Leonardo was one of the first artists to actually dissect and closely draw the interior aspects of a human body. And of course, once it was discovered what was inside a woman, you get quite different kinds of composition, because you will notice that this pregnant woman sits, she looks down as if in shame of her own body, everything exposed to the viewer, but on either side of her there are these hybrid figures, of course, which are known as grotesques. And of course the association is very obvious between the two. Now, ancient attitudes and taboos related to blood, not least concerning women's ability to bleed yet not die. Blood was seen as both life-giving and polluting, with many cultures harbouring deep-seated fears of menstruating women. In the first century CE, Pliny the Elder reported in his Natural History that some products of women's bodies had marvellous properties, the most powerful being the menstrual fluid. It was known that contact with it would turn new wine sour, crops touched by it became barren, grafts of trees would die, seeds in gardens would dry up, and the fruits of trees would fall off. The bright surface of mirrors in which it was merely reflected would be dimmed, hives of bees die, even bronze and iron ore would at once be seized by rust, and a horrible smell would fill the air. To taste it drove dogs mad, and it infected their bites with incurable poison. During the moon's eclipse, sexual intercourse with a menstruating woman brought disease and instant death, and it could even be used as an insecticide. Who would ever have guessed? But menstruation, of course, in religious terms, stood for the mark of Eve, her curse for eating the fruit in the Garden of Eden. So this was much debated too by the church, because on the one hand they knew that it was necessary for health, yet it had this strong association with sin. Now originally the tent in Piero della Madonna's Piero's Madonna was a deep red colour, the same colour as blood. And whereas the enclosed pregnant body had traditionally been seen to emulate the virgin state as a pure vessel, you sinned in conceiving but were in a state of grace while pregnant precisely because you no longer bled, the unfettered body with its monthly purge of blood was seen as inevitably tainted and unpure. After birth, women remained at home until such time as all bleeding had ceased, after which they went veiled to church to be blessed and purified. Known as being churched, superstitions about the power of blood meant that even in Protestant Europe, women continued to carry out this Catholic ritual. But what of the midwife, who we've seen in these earlier works? Once anatomy started to be understood, men, male doctors in particular, gradually took the power away from women to deliver children. Midwives didn't train, unless under another midwife. Knowledge was handed down from generation to generation. But with the institution of universities of medicine, gradually midwives were banned from attending a number of births. But I love this book that I found in Florence, Delivery of a Fat Woman, because if anyone believed that a woman would be able to give birth in that position, they have to be joking. But you start to get published a lot of books where prints are used to speak against the danger of midwives who haven't had an education. And one of the most famous is Trusty Eckhart's Careless Midwife. And you will see the poor woman is left in her birthing chair, but these twins have been delivered in pieces. Now, so you can imagine, women giving birth really faced it with often a lot of trepidation. So it's not surprising that there are sculptures like the one on the left, which actually is, it's called a balia, which is the Florentine term for wet nurse or midwife, but it actually shows the Virgin Mary as a miraculous midwife who will intervene and help with your delivery. But the other recourse was to pray to St. Margaret, the patron saint of childbirth, and she got this title because it was believed she'd been eaten by a dragon and burst forth unscathed from his belly, which seemed a very good metaphor for birth. And there's a really lovely prayer that was written to her, which a lot of women had recourse to before they gave birth. And part of it says, especially when a woman, big with child, turns her devout heart towards you and humbly begs you that God may save her from peril and may not delay his help to her. This is when I pray to you, honoured Virgin, noble and blessed martyr, through your blessed passion, through your saintly petition, may you pray to God for me and sweetly ask him that he may comfort me through his pity in the pain which I have to undergo, and that he, without danger to soul or body, make my child come out safe. And she then ends up, and to others in similar cases, through you be sweet and favourable. After Madonna was banned, you start to get images such as this, where reference to the actual process of birth has been completely removed, but her foot has had to be encased in gold because so many people kiss it in the hope that it will help women through childbirth. But for me, it's these early iconic images that have the most potency. The figure on the left is a carved votive that would have been within a domestic house. But you can also see the links, particularly in these two works, to Ron Merck's Pregnant Madonna. And I hope that this unravelling will allow you to go back into the exhibition and look with new eyes at his particular sculpture. So I'll stop there.